This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. As Fresh Air's TV critic, I'd like to open today's show by saying a few words about Michael Jackson, who died yesterday of cardiac arrest at the age of 50. For the 24-hour cable news networks, which also dealt with the death of Charlie's Angels star Farrah Fawcett the same day, it was a case of major media overload. But the Michael Jackson story trumped all others. And fittingly, the best tribute came from MTV. Michael Jackson, as the young frontman of the Jackson 5, was a star at an incredibly young age, racking up an amazing string of number one hits in the early 1970s. His group's appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show, while not as significant in terms of breaking down racial barriers as some of the acts Sullivan showcased in the 50s and 60s, were memorable. So was the reaction of the Sullivan Show audience.
From Gary, Indiana, here is the youthful Jackson 5.
But in television, as in the recording industry, Michael Jackson made his biggest impact and his most significant contributions once he went solo. The year was 1983. MTV had launched 2 years earlier, and it's difficult to remember or imagine how different a network it was back then. Not only did it play nothing but music videos 24 hours a day, but it played music videos only by white artists. The performer who broke MTV's unofficial blacklist, or whitelist, was Michael Jackson, with a video and song too catchy to ignore. He danced, lighting up squares on a floor with every step, and MTV and a superstar were reborn. The song was Billie Jean.
She was more like Beauty Queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who could dance on the floor in the round.
On MTV, Billie Jean was the first blow of a two-pronged attack. Beat It, which borrowed its imagery from a gang street fight in West Side Story, became another number one hit for Michael Jackson 2 months later. And that same month, March 1983, Jackson appeared on a live NBC Entertainment special honoring the 25th anniversary of Motown Records, the label on which the Jackson 5 had recorded. Michael Jackson reunited with his brothers and sang that night, but he also made a solo appearance that remains one of the most electrifying star turns in TV history. He performed Billie Jean, introducing a new dance move he had concocted for the occasion, a backwards gliding step he called the moonwalk. Viewers went crazy, critics raved, and even Fred Astaire phoned Jackson the next day to offer his praise. "You are incredible," Astaire told him. "You are a hell of a mover." Not even Madonna, who became a pop star later that year because of a string of sexy videos, could unseat Michael Jackson as MTV's biggest, most influential artist. Thriller, the album from which he drew an unprecedented number of hits, sold an absurd number of copies. By the time Michael Jackson bestowed upon himself the title The King of Pop, there was no denying it. Throughout the 80s, he used his clout and his talent to make one ornate music video after another, strengthening MTV's appeal as well as his own. Say the titles of Jackson's hits, and you're likely to remember the images as quickly as the music. Bad, The Way You Make Me Feel, Dirty Diana, Black or White. But if Michael Jackson's biggest contribution to live TV was his Billie Jean moonwalk, his greatest contribution to all TV history was his 1984 music video Thriller. Directed by John Landis of National Lampoon's Animal House, it was the longest single-song music video ever made, a record I believe it still holds. It had a storyline which made it a mini-movie, and a well-rehearsed, inventively presented dance sequence featuring Michael Jackson and other dancers as a group of choreographed zombies that has become positively iconic. And who can forget Michael's confession to his girl at the start of Thriller, just before he transformed?
"I have something I want to tell you. Yes, Michael.
I'm not like other guys.
Of course not. That's why I love you.
No, I mean I'm different.
What are you talking about? Are you all right?
Delaware!
More recently, Michael Jackson's TV history has been more tabloid coverage than music appreciation. A baby on a balcony, a creepy primetime interview, lawsuits involving underage boys, and so on. But now, with his death, all those images, all those stories, are folded together. Yesterday and today, while most networks covering Jackson's death were using his music videos only as a visual backdrop while interviewing everyone they could reach, MTV did something different. It checked in with other celebrities too, but MTV spent most of its time just playing Michael Jackson's massive library of music videos and live performances. On CNN, MSNBC, and elsewhere, you could hear about what made Michael Jackson such a pop culture icon. But on MTV, you could witness it all over again. Coming up, actor Gabriel Byrne. This is Fresh Air. And now, we shift from a performer who mesmerized people by dancing and singing to one who captivates fans by sitting and listening. Our guest today is Gabriel Byrne, who stars as therapist Paul Weston on the HBO series In Treatment. Based on an Israeli TV drama, In Treatment features Byrne as Paul working through a weekly schedule of therapy appointments. Monday through Thursday, as depicted in half-hour TV episodes, he meets weekly with four separate patients. On Friday, he sees his own therapist, allowing us a window into what he's thinking. Season 1 of In Treatment is out on DVD, and Season 2, which concluded recently on HBO, is showing now on HBO Signature and available on HBO On Demand. Gabriel Byrne, who also starred in Miller's Crossing and The Usual Suspects, spoke with Terry Gross earlier this year. They started with a clip from the second season of In Treatment, in which Byrne, as Paul, is listening to a patient named Mia, played by Hope Davis. She's a successful lawyer and has had several affairs with married men, including a colleague who just broke up with her. After talking to Paul about the two men she slept with over the weekend, she starts talking about her father.
You make him sound perfect.
Is that bad?
Can you think of a downside to it?
A downside to having a father who loves me? No. The problem is, I can't find anybody as good as him.
You think there's something wrong with that, don't you?
Well, for one thing, your father is married to your mother. Do you think there's any connection between that and your picking married men?
I said that I was done with that.
You did. But you also asked me what that pattern was about.
Now you're going to tell me that my father molested me? Hmm? Because he didn't.
I didn't think that. But your father has been an essential comfort for you. For as long as you're his favorite, you won't ever be alone. I'm getting the feeling that the tight bond isn't entirely comfortable.
What do you mean?
Well, look at this morning. You came in, you crossed a boundary. It made you feel special. But I think it also rattled you. Your speech was fast, graphic. You tried to provoke me. You spilled something.
The spill was an accident.
Maybe, but what I'm saying, Mia, is that it's not always a simple thing to be special. I was thinking of the feeling that you had when you were 8 after the robbery in your father's store, and he held you. It was too tight. It was life and death. Do you think it's possible that to separate from your father is to risk being entirely alone? But to stay with him is to be uncomfortably close.
Why are you doing this? My dad is all I have.
No one else?
Colleagues, acquaintances.
Is he your closest relationship? Are you his?
I feel sick. I eat too much. This is like anti-therapy. I walk in here feeling great. I'm gonna leave feeling like crap.
Sometimes that happens.
That's Gabriel Byrne and Hope Davis in a scene from In Treatment. Gabriel Byrne, welcome to Fresh Air. You are so good in this role.
Thank you, dear.
Are people coming up and confessing their problems to you or talking with you, you know, about their therapist because you're so convincing and so sympathetic as a therapist, not always in your personal life in the series, but as a therapist?
Yes, one or two people have come up to me and engaged me in conversations about their, in one case, very private life. And I hasten to reassure these people that I'm actually not real. I don't have a practice in Brooklyn, and that they should actually seek professional help.
So let me bluntly ask you the question that I know everybody probably always wants to ask you, which is, in preparation for this role, did you go into therapy or had you already been in therapy and understood what the process was like?
I had never been in therapy. I had known a few psychotherapists, but never actually took part in the process myself. But I understood that it was about listening. And listening, I think, is one of the most profound compliments that you can pay to another person, to truly listen. And to feel that you're heard is deeply fulfilling in a deep human way. I knew it was about that. The thing was how to make drama out of listening. And so therefore, television, because it uses the close-up so frequently, allows you to do that, because by some magic alchemy, if you're thinking something or feeling it, the camera will capture it.
You said this is a series that's in part about listening, that your job, your role, your performance is in part about listening. That's one of the reasons why I love the series, because it's about listening and often about asking good questions. That's theoretically what I'm supposed to be doing on the show.
Yeah.
So well, it's like you've heroicized the act of listening.
Yes, I think that it's, as I said, listening is a really profound thing to do. I mean, we hear sometimes, but we don't actually really listen. And when we start to listen, it's the beginning of a deeper awareness.
But you know what? But listening isn't a great visual experience. Like watching somebody listen isn't usually a great visual experience. I know from the very few times I did television that when the camera would come on me, when I was listening to somebody's answer to my question, I would look, inert, which you as an actor can't afford to look on camera. So what do you need to do to make listening an action that the camera can really pick up?
Well, if you've ever observed a child listening, they're so engaged in the act of listening. I was in a cafe one night about two years ago, and I saw a man and a woman at a table by the window, and she was so absorbed in everything that he was saying. He was talking about, obviously, something that was personal to them. But in the act of engaging with him by listening, she was outside herself. And I looked at that moment and I thought, that's what listening is, when you're absolutely absorbed in what the other person is saying. Now, the challenge of acting is that you don't hear everything just once. You have to hear it several times, because you have to do take after take after take. But to constantly be absorbed and to try to be outside yourself so that you're not aware of listening, because really, truly, profoundly listening is to be unaware of yourself at a deep level. So you asked me if I had done any research for this. I had seen priests in confession, obviously being a Catholic brought up in Ireland. I had seen how they sometimes perfunctorily listened, because there's many ways of pretending to listen. And I also find that very interesting to observe, the way people fake listening and fake engagement. And I knew that if this thing was going to succeed, it had to be, that had to be convincing first and foremost. And I watched, you talk about yourself as an interviewer, I watched Dick Cavett tapes, and I was very keenly interested in the way that he didn't always have the right question. And sometimes he got a little bit uncomfortable, and sometimes his body language was a little uncomfortable as well. And that to me looked like real, as opposed to, you know, let's, you know, convince everybody that I'm totally comfortable and everything is going smoothly. Sometimes silence is more powerful than the actual words that are spoken. And silence is something that, say, somebody like Harold Pinter or Beckett in the theater really truly understood, that words sometimes are not more powerful than silence.
Now, your character is so good at being a therapist, although he sometimes makes some pretty serious mistakes. But on the whole, he's such a sensitive and just really engaged therapist. But your character is also in pain in his own life. His own life isn't going well. I mean, right now, he's separated from his wife. He misses his children. They're in Baltimore. He's moved to Brooklyn. And you've made other mistakes in your private life, too, in the series. So you have your own therapist, and 1 half hour of each week is devoted to sessions with your therapist, who's named Gina, and is played by Diane Wiest. And years ago, she used to be your supervisor. So let me just play a brief clip from one of your sessions with your therapist.
I hate my life. It's broken. Every day, it hurts. I'm not getting anything from my family, so I try to get it from my patients. I know it's wrong, but who else do I have?
Who else do you have to get what you need from?
Nobody. Well, okay, I have you. But you can't give me what I need. See, it's not your job.
Let's talk about what you need.
Do you have any water? You're supposed to have water for your patients.
Paul, you're so convinced that I won't have any water for you, you don't see it. It's sitting right there.
Thanks.
So, can you tell me what you need?
I don't need anything special, just what everybody needs.
Well, you have food, you have clothing, you have shelter.
Well, sort of. I have a den with no other bears. Is that shelter?
You need some other bears?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I miss them. You know what I'm talking about. I know you do.
Gabriel Byrne, you want to just explain what the reference to bears is?
I think the reference is to his children and to an intimate life, and that although he deals in one way, in a very intimate way, with patients, it's a poor substitute for the intimacy of his family, which he's separated from. He also is without a relationship in his life and without a partner. So he's a vulnerable, compassionate, angry man. And I have to say here that, you know, I can bring those qualities of compassion and anger and vulnerability and whatever to the character, but I wouldn't be able to do that if it wasn't for the writing. And the writing, you know, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. And Warren Light, who heads up the writing team, I think they just did a spectacular job in making this seem very ordinary conversation at times, but yet very real.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview with Gabriel Byrne. Byrne is the star of HBO's In Treatment, the excellent and increasingly addictive drama series about a psychotherapist and his patients. Byrne, who became a movie star thanks to a starring role in Miller's Crossing by the Coen brothers, didn't come to the U.S. until he was in his late 30s. He was born in Dublin, and Terry asked Gabriel Byrne about his earlier years.
Now, you grew up in Dublin and didn't come to the United States till you were about, well, in your late 30s. And shortly after coming to the States, you made Miller's Crossing, a film in which you played a gangster. Correct me if I'm wrong in this. You were educated by the Irish Christian Brothers. Is that a Jesuit? A Jesuit group?
No. There's the Jesuits. They're a much more sophisticated outfit altogether. The Christian Brothers were a teaching order, and they were known for their strictness, rigidity, and Victorian approach to discipline. Spare the rod and spoil the child was their kind of philosophy. And sometimes that resulted in inhumane and cruel treatment of people who were in their charge. I say that not with any anger, but just as a fact.
What did you have to experience?
I think everybody that I know who was brought up in those times expected that was just the status quo. Certainly cruelty on an almost daily basis. I was just looking at a kind of diary that I had kept, like a kind of child's diary at the time, and I confided to this diary that I didn't know why I was being hit, because I didn't understand, you know, if Jack has 3 stones in his pocket and Tom has 4 stones in his pocket, how many stones does the Bishop of Cork have if he lives in Paris, or something meaningless like that? You'd say, I have no idea what that means. And they'd hit you anyway. So I didn't understand why I was being hit. And I remember, not to be too Dickensian about it, but I do remember winter mornings with one of these men, you know, who'd had a brain operation and now read everything upside down. So we all had to learn to read things upside down on the blackboard so that we wouldn't, you know, rise his anger. And this guy would just give you what he called 12 of the best on each frozen hand, I remember, in wintertime. That may sound a little, you know, Dickensian and dramatic, but it was the truth.
It also sounds bizarre.
Yes. Well, when you have men who have taken a life oath of celibacy, and they are denied the basic comfort of human connection and warmth, and celibacy is something that I absolutely detest within the Catholic Church. I think it's an appalling outrage against humanity to make people. It's not like. I'm not really a religious person, but it's not like Christ came down from heaven and said, look, okay, you've all got to be celibate. It was something that was introduced in the 11th century so the church wouldn't have to pay the dependence of priests who died. So celibacy is a man-made thing. And so you have these people who give up the possibility of human contact and warmth, and you have them in front of 50 kids. And they're told that they can hit with impunity, and that discipline is to be meted out for any transgression or perceived transgression. So the stage was set for all kinds of abuse, both physical and sometimes more than that.
I think I'd read that you had also studied to be a priest, that you for a period you planned to be a priest. Is that not right?
Yeah, I spent, at that time there was a very strange thing that was, you know, they used to recruit young boys. I mean, I was 11 years of age, and this guy came into the school one day And he showed these slides on the wall about, you know, working in Africa. And I thought, wow, that looks really nice. There's rivers and horses and smiling kids. And the guy's got a straw hat on. That looks like a good job. And at the end, he said, well, how many boys would like to do that? And I said, I'd like to do that. So I found myself leaving from Dublin on the mail boat to go to England when I was 11 to study to be a priest. And at that time, to be a priest was to be called by God. It gave great honor and blessing to the family whose son was called to be a priest. And I went there and spent 4.5 years and lost my vocation, I say. But they made the mistake. The priests who ran the place, they made the mistake of inviting a group of traveling players to the school, and these traveling players included two girls, one of whom was in a black slip with black stockings. How she got in, I don't know, but anyway, she was on the stage and she created havoc and chaos among the 200 to be priests. And I have a memory just of a gaslight and her standing under this lamplight with this with her leg showing, and me thinking, now that's what I want. And when they left, we were all hanging out the dormitory windows, all these so-called apprentice priests, and she waved from the little bus that they got into, and she waved to me, and I waved back to her, and I blew her a kiss, and she got in the bus and disappeared. And then I looked and I saw there was 200 other guys hanging out the window, and they all thought the same thing. But many vocations were lost that night, and I often wonder who that woman was, because I thank her.
So when, you know, obviously you were serious enough about religion to spend several years in a seminary, when you were invited to leave the seminary, did you leave God behind?
Not immediately, but I suppose I had what they call a crisis of faith. And I remember once saying, God, if you're up there, strike me down if I say something bad against you. And I said, I don't like you, God, or something to that effect, something kind of adolescent or childish, and nothing happened. And I thought, well, maybe there's nobody really up there. And life took over, just the thrill and excitement of being 17, 18 years of age, being able to walk through the streets of London and seeing things like, guys standing outside these strip clubs saying, come on in.
And you had permission to go. There was nothing holding you back anymore.
There was nobody there to say, well, there was a little voice in my head saying, you'll be damned forever in a mortal hellfire. But it kind, when you weighed it against the possibility of seeing a naked woman, you kind of said, well, So it was a bit, that was what my crisis of faith was. Naked women are hell forever.
But at some point, you didn't have to choose between the two.
No.
I'm sure you realized you could have naked women. And if you wanted, you could have some sense of God in your life. Did you choose to keep one, or were you kind of done with that?
I was done with that kind of God. My life since then, I think, has been about a search for some kind of God. And I wouldn't say that I'm religious in any way, but I think that I move towards some version of being spiritual.
Gabriel Byrne, star of HBO's In Treatment, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Gabriel Byrne plays a psychotherapist on HBO's In Treatment. And in most therapy sessions, the discussion eventually leads to early childhood for clues about motivation and behavior. So when Terry interviewed Gabriel Byrne earlier this year, they naturally wound up talking about his early childhood growing up in Ireland.
It was a working-class family in Dublin, and my father was a labourer, and he had to work really, really hard. And my mother was a nurse who had to work nights, and there was six kids in the family. And, you know, that produces its own stresses and strains. And I remember when the Brady Bunch came out, and I used to hate the Brady Bunch. Only now in retrospect I can understand why I might have hated it, because they seemed like such paragons of virtue that they would say things like, "Mom, Dad, can we have a meeting?" And I know if I said that to my father, he would have just looked at me and said, you know, "What?" You know, so they were all such happy, and every problem that they had every week was resolved within 26 seconds by the father, the mother, the maid who served them orange juice, and each other. So they represented a kind of an idealized family, which when I looked at not just my family, but other families around, we were coping with real life, and it wasn't just like that. So it kind of bred a kind of an unconscious resentment in me that I'm only beginning to understand now.
You know, part of me is wondering how come you don't want to go into therapy. And the reason why I ask this is, having become a big fan of In Treatment, like, I've never been in therapy, but watching In Treatment, I sometimes think, wow, that's so interesting. Like, the process is so interesting. Maybe I should go into therapy. It just looks so fascinating and revealing. And I know what you're doing is drama as opposed to, like, the reality of therapy, and the two would be a little different. The revelations would probably come a lot slower in real life. But nevertheless, there's something very seductive, too, about the idea of somebody devoting such complete attention to solving the mystery of who you are and why you do what you do. So having immersed yourself in therapy as an actor for In Treatment, how come you're not seduced by the idea? How come you haven't wanted to go into therapy afterwards?
Well, I could throw the question back at you and say that you sound almost like you want to go into therapy yourself. You're just waiting for the right nudge to go in there. I could do you a good rate. I'll do you 20% discount. But for the same reasons, like you, I'm kind of fascinated by the notion of somebody giving their full and very considered opinion to the narrative of my life. I think what a good psychotherapist does, I imagine, is that they help you to write the real narrative of your life and come to terms with it. Because I think we have a tendency when we talk about our lives to kind of magnify certain things and give them an importance, idealize certain things and be in denial about other things. And looking at the narrative of your life and how that influences who you are as an adult cannot be but, I think, a good process.
No, I think that's really well put. One of the things you did after leaving the seminary was you went to college, you studied archaeology and linguistics, and I think this is where you learned to speak and write Gaelic.
Mm-hmm.
And not growing up in Ireland or anything, I don't know how many people are left who actually speak that language and how much it's considered just like an archaic or literary language. What is the answer to that?
Gaelic is an ancient language and a really beautiful one. And Oscar Wilde said about English. He said the English stole our language, and we learned it and returned it to them with great beauty. I mean, it was a little bit Oscar Wilde-ish to say that, but the truth is that up until 1860 or 65, almost everybody in Ireland spoke Gaelic. And within 100 years, Ireland adopting English as its premier language produced Shaw, Yeats, Wilde, Beckett, O'Casey, Singh, some of the greatest writers of the 20th century. Yeats redefined poetry, Joyce redefined the novel, and Beckett redefined theatre. That was all in 100 years. It is a most complex and beautiful language, and with a wealth of great poetry and prose that most people don't really know about. It's a It's a beautiful language that's been revived, and people are beginning to take a new interest in it, just like they did with, for a long time, Irish dancing was reviled and, you know, disregarded, and now it's like the hip and cool thing to do. To speak your own language is a very hip and cool thing to do, and to be robbed of your language is to be robbed of the way you think.
Can you maybe recite a few lines in Gaelic from a poem you particularly love and translate it for us?
That's a hard one. Okay, I'll try. Fornach the connachtua all in a hall you. Is the gallus mahul eragla eragla good lishfin. The gunus mahluas eragla. It's a half-remembered fragment from Patrick Pearse, who was one of the rebel leaders of 1916. And it translated, it means, because, again, going back to naked women, Ireland stands in for, a naked woman stands in for Ireland, and he talks about, naked I saw you, beauty of beauties, and I blinded my eyes that I would not see you. My ears I closed that I would not hear you. Is on road shorom aig the hugus. That's the last two lines of it, and it says, and on this road before me I gave my face. In other words, I turned my face towards this road before me.
You know, as an actor, you've played all kinds of characters, some, you know, very reflective and gentle father figure, some like very brutal, like in Miller's Crossing, and also, you're a criminal in The Usual Suspects. Having grown up, like come of age in a seminary, was it at all difficult to get in touch with the brutal side of yourself, to unleash that? Were you comfortable unleashing it when you had to for roles?
I think we all have within us the capacity to be angry. And accessing anger. It's interesting that when I sometimes go to and I look at drama students, you know, working, becoming actors, the first place that the men go to is anger, and the first place that the women go to is tears. It's just an interesting thing that it's easiest to access for them, whereas men accessing tears seems to be more difficult. Possibly because the culture doesn't endorse the notion of men and tears, but anger seems to be an accessible emotion. Repressed anger is something I have worked with in my work, and I find it a safe place to let it out there. Because I think that anger is a real emotion, and, you know, I try not to be afraid of it. I heard a woman the other day. I sometimes go to this church in Brooklyn, and the woman, the preacher, was talking about how our bodies are repositories for our feelings, and how we store anger in our bodies. And I thought that was quite a good point to make.
So you said you sometimes go to this church, but you also told us that you no longer really practice religion. Why do you go to church?
Because I think that to be encased in silence for three quarters of an hour in that way is, I find it nourishing and relaxing for the soul. It's a nice church. They sing nice hymns. There's beautiful stained glass, flowers. There's usually a good sermon. And the seats are comfortable.
Gabriel Byrne, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too, Terry. And if you go to therapy, I will.
I'll let you know.
Okay, I'll check in with you again, make sure.
Okay. Oh, good deal.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All the best.
Gabriel Byrne, star of HBO's In Treatment, speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. Season 1 of In Treatment is out on DVD, and Season 2, with a different set of patients, can be seen on HBO Signature and HBO On Demand. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews a new war movie, The Hurt Locker. This is Fresh Air. Director Kathryn Bigelow is widely acclaimed for two films with cult followings, 1985's poetic outlaw vampire saga Near Dark and 1991's Daredevil movie Point Blank. Her profile has been lower since then, but that might change with her latest film, The Hurt Locker. It tracks an Army Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit, or bomb squad, in Iraq in 2004. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Some filmmakers know how to get under your skin and control your responses, to infect you, and Kathryn Bigelow is among the most gifted. Here's how I knew her Baghdad-set war movie The Hurt Locker was inside me. The characters were in a fierce desert firefight, and Jeremy Renner's Sergeant William James had grabbed the rifle of a soldier who'd just been shot down. It jammed because the bullets were sticky with blood, and James pulled them out, and as enemy shots exploded around him, he dumped them into the hands of a neophyte soldier. He yelled, "Clean them off," and the soldier yelled, "How?" And James said, "Saliva." And at that moment, I swear, I found myself building up spit because it was all so crazy fast, and I thought, I can help. And there was no time even to laugh at myself. Set in 2004, The Hurt Locker centers on an American bomb squad. No, centers is wrong, since the film doesn't feel as if it has a center. It veers from one gut-churning mission to the next. Screenwriter Mark Boal was embedded as a journalist in Iraq with an explosive ordnance disposal unit. He and Bigelow take their theme from a book by Christopher Hedges that war is, quote, a drug, a potent and lethal addiction. That line opens the movie, and I think putting it on screen is a mistake. It pins down the thesis. But Bigelow has certainly made it live. The camera moves are sudden, the cuts a beat too quick. The jumps from close-up to long shot signal explosions are imminent, even when they're not. Bigelow is in sync with men under threat from all angles, and the men, their weapons cocked, are alert to everything. A pop, a head poking from a window, a wire snaking out from a mound of debris. The Hurt Locker isn't like other Iraq films, which lead with American paralysis and guilt. The horror is here, but underneath the rush. There is a conventional dramatic conflict. It's between Renner's James and Anthony Mackie's Sergeant J.T. Sanborn, who thinks James is a cowboy, a danger to the unit. Their tug-of-war plays out over and over as James dons the astronaut-like bomb suit and walks toward a potential explosive, a new pyrotechnical puzzle, while Sanborn's men pirouette and scan surrounding buildings and bystanders. After one successful bomb defusion, James is accosted by a colonel played by David Morse.
You the guy in the flaming car, Sergeant James?
Good afternoon, sir.
Yes, sir. You're a wild man, you know that?
Yes, sir.
He's a wild man, you know that? Why don't you shake your hand?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure, sir.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked you a question.
873, sir.
873. 873.
They're counting today, sir, yes.
That's got to be a record. What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That's a good one. That's spoken like a wild man. That's good.
The Hurt Locker dramatizes what other Iraq films haven't, that innocent civilians can buckle under the pressure too, freezing in their cars or striding up to overanxious troops with bizarre pleasantries. The movie is so disorienting, you never guess who has a detonator or who'll end up dead. Name actors, memorably Ralph Fiennes as a brusque private contractor, pop up and go out with shocking speed. The less-known actors keep you guessing, too. Renner doesn't overplay James's hot dog persona. The character's focus is on the explosives, with no wasted motions, no grandstanding. And Mackie Sanborn is so infuriated by Renner's lack of caution, there's at least a chance he'll engineer an accident and take out his comrade himself. It's only after the film ends and your fight-or-flight instincts ebb that you might wonder about the movie's politics, or lack of them. The question of what these men are doing in a culture they don't understand, with a language they can't speak and people they can't read, hangs in the air, but is never posed. Yet maybe that's why The Hurt Locker rises above its didactic counterparts. Catherine Bigelow has always been enthralled by the macho warrior, the existential daredevil, and she's so deep inside these soldiers' testosterone-soaked psyches that the question of why has no meaning. Sensation is all. And this is, in all senses, a sensational film.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. Stranger, electric eyes are everywhere.